Well,
we are in Luke chapter 15, and since it's been a while, we'll get a little bit of a running start on this, but it is interesting, just the way it turns out, that we are talking about the Father on Father's Day, and this is just a great illustration. I was talking with Cody this morning. We're in the copper room just kind of getting ready, and he said, "Where are you at in Luke?" And kind of bring him up to date. And I said, "You know, the one thing I love about this," I said, "when I was looking at Luke and, you know, the story of the prodigal son, I said, yeah, I could have busted it out in a week. You know, we could have just taken this passage. But I said, there's so much in there. And there's just three main characters as this drama unfolds. And I think you see yourself in each of them. I think there are times in each of our lives, and I mentioned this last time I talked, when we talked about the younger son, but I think there are times in our lives where each of us could say, yeah, there were times when I was that younger son. And I think today you'll find that there are times when you were the father. And I'm sure next time in a couple of weeks you'll see, well, there were times I was that elder brother too. And you'll find yourself in these, and I think that's a good thing. That helps make the word relevant. It helps us to apply it. But we're in Luke 15, and just to sort of set a context, because again, it's been 3 weeks. Jesus is, I'm going to go all the way back up to verse 1, where it says, "Now all the tax gatherers and the sinners were coming to him and listening to him." So Jesus is teaching. He is on his way to Jerusalem. He's probably out of Galilee, probably in Perea or Judea, and he's teaching. And it said, "The Pharisees and the scribes began to grumble, saying, 'This man receives sinners and eats with them.'" And that's what verse 2 says. And that kind of set up the context for the rest of the chapter. Because we have another typical situation where Jesus is ministering to people that the Pharisees deemed unworthy of ministering to. These were sinners. These were the lowlifes. These were the people that you just didn't bother with. And because Jesus was a rabbi, and their rabbis, they judge him for that. Look at this guy, he's doing this again. And we've seen this encounter before. And Jesus, at another time, has kind of called out the Pharisees for this. This time he doesn't do that, he simply starts telling stories. And about a month ago we talked about a couple of short stories he tells in verses sort of 3 through 10, where he talks about a guy who has 100 sheep and loses one and leaves everything to go find it. And then another one about a woman who has 10 coins and loses one and kind of drops everything and cleans the whole house till she finds the one coin. And the point of both of those sort of mini parables, if you will, was the value of what is lost and how the right thing to do when something is lost is to find it, to seek after it, to search, to get what is lost. And then Jesus goes into, for the rest of chapter 15, this much more long, much more elaborate story that we've all come to know as the prodigal son, right? And it's one that, you know, goes back, you've heard me use this before, it goes back to the flannel board days, those of us of that generation, you know, that, you know, this is one you learned right off. It's sort of culturally universal. You know, there are references to it in literature, Shakespeare, where, I mean, you can just say the prodigal son or the fatted calf, and people just kind of know what you're talking about. So it's a universal story, and it's got three main characters, and last time we talked about the son. It kind of covered verses about 11 to 20-ish. Today, I want to look at the role of the father, and that'll be about verses 20 to 24, and then in a couple of weeks, we'll pick it up with the elder brother that kind of takes us from 25 on through the end of the chapter. So that's sort of where we are. And even as we read, I'm going to go all the way back to 11 just to get us a running start. And I'm going to read 11 through 24. So it said, "And he said," Jesus said, "a certain man had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me.' And he divided his wealth between them. And not many days later, the younger son gathered everything together and went on a journey into a distant country. And there he squandered his estate with loose living. Now when he had spent everything, a severe famine occurred in that country, and he began to be in need. And he went and attached himself to one of the citizens of that country, And he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he was longing to fill his stomach with the pods that the swine were eating, and no one was giving him anything to eat. But when he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread, and mine here is dying with hunger? I'll get up and go to my father, and I'll say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men.'" And he got up and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to the father, "Father, I have sinned against you. I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his slaves, "Quickly, bring out the best robe and put it on him. And put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet. And bring the fatted calf, kill it. Let us eat and be merry. For this son of mine was dead and has come to life again. He was lost and has been found." And they began to be merry. Well, like I said, last time we spoke of this rebellious young man, he demanded his inheritance before it was due, right? He wanted it now. He basically said, "Dad, I wish you were dead. I want my share now." And his father gave it to him, and he spent it all. He enjoyed it, and then he found himself in a foreign land, no friends, no hope, and he is reduced to working for a Gentile. Remember, this is a Jewish boy, working for a Gentile, taking care of pigs. And believe me, in Jewish culture, that is about as far down the ladder as you can really go. Finally, he kind of comes to his senses and musters up the courage to go home. And he's going to face his father. And he has no hopes of being welcomed back or joining the family or being forgiven. He just wants to sort of be in the same situation that he is, a hired laborer, but just, if I want to do this, I might as well do it for my dad around people I know, and, you know, dad seems to take better care of his workers than this guy does, because I still don't have enough to eat here. So if I'm just going to be reduced to a day laborer, I might as well go home and do it in a place I'm comfortable with. And that's where he goes. So today we're going to talk about the father, and to get your mind into the father, this guy is heartbroken, right? He had loved that son, and that son had defied him. He had given that son, there's every indication he had given him a good upbringing, and this kid just looked at him, said, "I wish you were dead, give me my share." And because the father did, he's been humiliated in the village, right? This father, the gossip of the neighbors, must have been horrible, talking about how his indulgence had been repaid. Well, that's what you get when you spoil your kids, right? The father had to listen to that. His son had dishonored him with his request, and the father only added to his own dishonor by giving into it. The boy had fled the area. Nobody knew where he was, what he was doing. Who knows what rumors came back. And I'm sure the locals just shook their head and said, "That's what you get. Serves you right." And the Pharisees who are listening to this story, because again, Jesus is talking to the Pharisees, are nodding in agreement with that. They're saying, "Yep, great story so far." Because that's exactly what happens. That's what happens to sinners. That's what sinners deserve. That is exactly what both the boy and his indulgent father deserve. That's how God treats people that don't obey the law. And so now we got this part of the story where the boy's coming home. And you can just sense what the Pharisees are listening for. They are listening for the wrath of the father to be poured out. Right there. Okay, this kid's coming back. That dad is going to give it to him good. Right? Because here's the one chance that this father has to sort of regain his position in the community. Right? He messed up the first time by giving the kid what he wanted. That didn't turn out. Now the boy's coming back. So the dad has a chance to kind of show the community, "No, I can be a good Jewish dad. Watch me punish my son. Watch me show him what he ought to get." Okay, that's what he can do. And that's what the Pharisees are waiting for. They're figuring that, okay, this boy's going to come back. He'll humble himself. The father will be cold and distant. Maybe after several years of letting him work, he'll get some sort of place in the family, but the father's going to make him pay. That's how the father is going to demonstrate he's learned the lesson. But that's not the story Jesus is going to tell. Right? Those Pharisees are going to be shocked by what Jesus is going to talk about. Because he's going to talk about a father that is as prodigal as his son. As extravagant as his son was. Though for a different reason and with a different outcome. So that's where we are. And you begin, while he was still a long way off, the father saw him. You know, the dad had never given up. And that's kind of an interesting sort of point to stop, because I'm an old guy with grown kids. And it is sort of an interesting question to ask myself. If my kids sort of turned away from the faith, how long would I pray for them? What would my time limit be? You know, and I'd like to think forever, right? I'd like to think that. I'd hope that would be true. But I think I know myself well enough to know how resentment might build up, especially if they did it in a way that was as defiant and rebellious to this dad. I mean, at what point did that dad not get just think, good riddance? I've got the elder son. You know, my estate is secure. I've got this elder son who's matured and who's still standing by me. You know, good riddance. That kid gets what he deserves. Right? If you're going to treat me, that had to be a temptation. I just can't imagine it not. But this dad apparently had not succumbed to that because he is still looking. Now, here's what's got to happen, right? We know what he's supposed to do when he sees his son. We know the cultural paradigm. Okay, the customs are this. The boy has sinned. The boy has been considered dead. They might even, remember we talked about it, they might even have had a funeral service. They would go that far. You know, this kid has rebelled against me in such a way I consider him dead, and they actually would do a service to sort of mark that in the community. Okay? So he sees the boy coming, and what he's supposed to do is nothing. Okay? When he sees that kid coming, he is supposed to not do anything. He's supposed to let this boy come and beg. And not even necessarily receive him at first. Because that would be sort of a sign of eagerness on the father's part to forgive, right? You're supposed to, okay, you wait outside. Maybe at the village gates. Maybe put him in a place where everybody in the village can see his humiliation. You're not going to welcome him into your home. You're going to make him sit out there and let everybody in the village, everybody who saw him sin, get a chance to kind of walk by and go, how'd that work out? How'd that work out? Right? Only when the whole village has mocked him, only when he's been spat on and kicked and shamed, only when his disgrace is complete, then the father might receive him. And that would go something like this. The son would come in and bow with his face to the ground and kiss his father's feet. The father's job is to be unemotional, cold and distant. This is how the father is going to show that he has restored himself to a place of honor in the village. That he's kind of learned his lesson from his indulgence. And after some humiliation like this, maybe the father's going to let his son become a servant. Maybe he's simply going to turn his back and walk away. Either of those options would be accepted. That's the expectation. That is what ought to happen. Okay, that is what honor in this culture would require. And it might seem really harsh. I hope it does, at any rate. I hope, you know, speaking to mostly parents in the room, you know, you would think, man, that's, come on, man. But again, we're coming at it from our 21st century Western culture paradigm, right? And we've got to kind of put ourselves where the story's happening, first century Palestine. And in this Jewish culture, that was appropriate. And an illustration that you're all familiar with is Joseph. Remember Joseph's story? His brother sold him down into slavery in Egypt? right? And he comes to power there. And then there's famine in the land of Canaan, so the brothers go down there. And Joseph, how's it go, right? Joseph was ruler over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. When Joseph's brothers came down, bowed with him, their faces to the ground, Joseph saw his brothers and recognized him, or recognized them. He disguised himself to them and spoke to them harshly. And then, as you know, the story goes on. He kind of makes them prove themselves, right? Remember, he says, no, I want my younger brother. You go back and get him. And then he kind of puts that cup in there and makes the younger brother look like he took it to say, okay, you're going to sell out somebody else? Right? I mean, he tests them, and only after an extended period of time of kind of proving that these brothers had genuinely repented of their sin, then he kind of breaks down and says, okay, you remember me? That's how it worked. That's what you do. That's the way the story ought to go. And again, we can feel that it's harsh, but this is actually rather lenient. You all, I am sure, at some point, have your parent have thought about or quoted this passage to your rebellious kids. If any man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey his father or mother, and when they chastise him, he will not even listen to him, then his father and mother shall seize him, bring him out to the elders of the city at the gateway of his hometown. They shall say to the elders of the city, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of the city shall stone him to death. So you shall remove the evil from your midst. All Israel will hear of it and fear. I mean, that's the harsh version, right? I mean, that's a card the father could have played at the beginning. That's a card the father still can play now. Everybody grab a rock. Right? The lenient side is to make the kid beg and earn forgiveness. So, those are the options. Those are the options. Again, the father is being lenient simply by not requiring his son be put to death. But that's not the way Jesus is going to tell the story, is it? And you get a clue right away in verse 20, because it says, the father, while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him. He felt compassion for him. His first response wasn't anger. It was sorrow. He was sorry for the sins his son had committed. He sympathized. He pitied. Now, he sees his son at a distance. And even from a distance, he's got to notice that his son is not coming back to this village the way his son had left. Right? Imagine, what does this father see? Because when his kid left, his kid had cashed out everything. He was flush, right? He had all his money. I'm sure he left as good as he could go. Right? I'm sure he had donkeys, he had possessions, he had fine clothes, he had cashed out, he had won the lottery. When he walked out of the village, when he rode out of the village, he was going fine. He was going to stay in the nice inns. He was living large. Now he's seeing his son, and you know what his son is doing? His son is walking. His son has been begging for his food. His son does not have nice clothes. That's what he sees. Even from a long way off, he can see his son and go, well, this kid isn't coming back to gloat, right? This kid isn't coming back to say, look how great it turned out, I tripled my money, right? This kid is coming back in rags. This kid is coming back beaten. The father could tell at first glance things had not gone well. His kid is in trouble. And again, the Pharisees are just eager for him to sort right off with, I told you. How many times did I tell you? I mean, you know the lectures, right? Wonder how long the father had been looking for his son. I can't imagine that this is sort of circumstances where it's the very first time the father's kind of, I wonder if my kid's coming back. you know? And, oh, there it is. What about that? You know, it's not possible, right?
This dad had to be looking all the time.
Maybe up on a roof. Maybe one of those towers. You put a tower out in the fields to kind of keep an eye on your crops from, you know, people that would take advantage of that, thieves or such like that. So he's been watching. Maybe he's had slaves watch, right? Like, man, I'm going to bed, but I want one of my slaves. You're always looking. You're always looking. We don't know how long the kid has been gone. It doesn't say in the Bible. I imagine it's reasonable to infer a few weeks, maybe a few months. I don't know how much money the kid had. Obviously, his family was wealthy, so he had a lot of money and he had a lot of time to spend. Not a lot of money, and it's a lot of time to spend it, so we don't know. But however long, the father had never given up hope. And it's interesting to think, because again, you've got this son who sort of rehearsed what he's going to say. Right? This kid, remember, he's sitting with the pigs, he's feeding them, and while he's out there, he's like, man, this is just not working. I'm going to go home. Okay, here's what I'm going to say. And I'm sure walking back, the kid has kind of played that out. Right? Here's what I got to say. Okay. Dad, I've sinned against heaven. I've got my speech ready. Don't you think the father did the same thing? In those hours while he's waiting, in his hours while he's looking, if I ever see my son again, here's what I'm going to say. Here's what I'm going to do. If I ever see my son again. And so he sees him at a distance. Now, what does that tell us? Well, it tells us it's daytime. Okay, that's not hard to figure, but if it's night, he's not out there with his searchlight, you know. I mean, you figure if you can see him at a distance, it's daytime, and that's important because it's daytime, it's in a village, that means everybody's up. People are doing their thing, getting water, shopping, I don't know, doing whatever they do in a village, but it's daytime, it's busy. And so the father sees his son a long way up, a long way off, and his first response, he feels compassion and he runs. Why? Is he just happy to see his son? Well, probably. Probably there's that excitement. But I think there's something more. I think he wants to get to his son first. He wants to be there with his son when the village notices his son has come back. Because I think what he's trying to do is spare his son some further humiliation. Remember, the whole village knows this kid's story, right? The whole village knew about this. Everybody's going to know his kid. They're going to see his condition. They're going to see that this kid is impoverished and begging and starving and in rags and smells like who knows what. They're going to know the story. And his dad doesn't want him to get mocked. His dad doesn't want those people to start, oh, you're that kid, I remember you. Yeah, you know what? His dad doesn't want that. Isn't that amazing to see that this offended father, his first inclination on seeing his son is to spare his son further damage, to spare his son further pain. That's his first move. He's the offended one, and his first play is to spare the offender further humiliation. That is extraordinary. That is absolutely extraordinary. You know, this guy is not a young man. He's got two grown sons. And so his emotions, he just takes off and he runs. And what that word run means is run. Okay, that's just what it means. It means sprint. It means like to run as in running a race. He's not jogging or trotting. He's not briskly walking or hurrying. He doesn't send a servant. He takes off and runs. You ever tried to run in sandals? I can't imagine that being easy. You know how they dress, these long outer garments. He's got to pull that up so he can run. I mean, that is a humiliating thing for a man to expose his legs like that. That is something you just don't do in that culture, then or now. I mean, this is embarrassing. This is humiliating to that father. He looks like a fool. But he's embarrassing himself for the sole purpose of saving his son more embarrassment.
Because he wants to be there when the village shows up and recognizes his boy. So he is willing to just humiliate himself and take off running. And again, I think it's worth considering because this is such a big deal in that culture. You know, I don't know what we think of. I'm one of those guys that I am kind of, I have my own sort of sin issue with this in that I don't mind being in front of people as long as I can control the situation. Right? But like, even if it's our family, I don't like being silly. And so like, if it's our family and it's a holiday and everybody wants to play charades, I'm like, oh my word, can't I just go do the dishes or something? Because I don't like being in front of people looking silly. I don't mind being in front of people if I'm in control, you know? And I might be looking silly now, but at least I feel like I'm in control, right? But in those kinds of situations where you're gonna, oh, that's so funny, like, you know, I hate that kind of thing. You know, this dad just couldn't care less. He doesn't care about his dignity. He doesn't care about the people are going to think of him. He just takes off. And again, in this culture, boys run, servants run, men don't run. And this is such a big deal. Did a little study on this. This passage in any Arabic translation is not described as run for like almost 2,000 years. They used other words. They used words like, I put them in here, they used things like he hurried or he presented himself. They don't tell, in an Arabic translation of this passage, they don't use the word the father ran until the 19th century, like 150 years ago. Because that would just sort of ruin it for any Arab reading this, a man to think, oh my gosh, this father, nobody, you're a man, forget about it. So they tried to kind of disguise it and not make it look that way. It was just too humiliating. Too unbelievable. So again, you know, we get this moment, and again, our culture, when I read this, I'm sure when you read it, what you picture is the movie scene, right? I mean, come on, we've all seen those romantic comedies where then they all rush together and the music gets loud and everybody, oh, you know, that is the way we see this. When Jesus is telling this story to his audience, this is a shameful, humiliating, disgraceful act for a father to run. And then he gets to his son and he embraces him and he kisses him. Now again, try to put your senses into this moment. Here's this kid. He has been on the road for days, a week, I don't know. Who knows the last time he went by a well and got some water, right? Before that, these clothes that he had, he was using to take care of pigs. Okay, those of you with any sort of agricultural experience, or if you just walk through the fairgrounds, you know, you kind of get that, there's an odor for you, right? And you kind of mix that with sort of the sweat and the dust and everything, and this dad just throws himself into his son and just begins to kiss him. And the wording means that he kissed him over and over again. He is unashamed, right? He had to be just sobbing. And he does all of this before the kid says a word. Right? I mean, for all we know at this point, the kid could be coming back to ask for more money. Right? We don't know. Right? I mean, we know the outcome of the story, but from within the story, the dad doesn't know what the kid's doing back in town. The dad just sees his kid is in big trouble. He's come back and he throws himself all over him and he forgives before forgiveness is even requested. That had to shock that kid. That had to be the last thing that kid expected. And I got to tell you, at this point, the Pharisees in the room are squirming. They are not enjoying this story anymore because that's not what's supposed to happen. They are sitting there grumbling their disapproval with what Jesus is talking about. The father did what? But Jesus is making a point. And the point that he's making is this. The Pharisees, you know, their understanding of God was based on fear. Right? God is holy and just and unwilling to leave any sin unpunished. And to the Pharisees, that meant that you'd all fallen short, and only by perfectly keeping the law can you merit forgiveness. That is sort of a Pharisee worldview. And Jesus also taught of a God who's holy and just and unwilling to leave any sin unpunished. But Jesus is talking about the inability of a fallen man to earn salvation. And so Jesus is talking about a God of grace. You know, this father is clearly, you've picked up on, he's a Christ figure. Right? He is the father in this one. He is the Christ figure. He offers his love unconditionally. Right? The father's actions occur even before the son speaks a word of repentance. And what does it say in Scripture? So too God demonstrates his own love toward us, and that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. The Father offers his love sacrificially. And so too did Christ, too. Although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant, being made in the likeness of men. Being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. The Father doesn't die, but this humiliation of running through the village, you know, his outer garment hiked up between his legs, stumbling through there, you know, pausing to catch his breath, sprinting some more, you know, I don't know what kind of physical fitness this guy was in, to go out and see his kid that he saw a mile or so out in the desert on his way. His father's humbling himself incredibly. And going through great shame. And so too did Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for this joy set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame. And that word despising just means to not let it bother him. Our Savior was humiliated on the cross. This is the description we have of this father. You know, the kid, he tries to do his speech, right? Right? For while he was a long way off, the father saw him, felt compassion for him, ran, embraced him, kissed him. The son said, Father, I have sinned against heaven, and in your sight I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. He doesn't make excuses, he doesn't try to mitigate it, but the father just shuts him off. He doesn't want anything to do with this. The kid can't even finish his speech. He never gets to the part about, can I be one of your hired servants? The father just interrupts him. This has nothing to do with that. You're back. You're back. The kid had a debt he couldn't repay. I mean, think about this kid. He has cashed out half of his father's estate, and it's all gone. Can the boy possibly pay that back? He can't pay that back. Not in his lifetime. There's no resources that the kid has to earn enough money to rebuild his half of his father's estate. This is a debt the kid can't pay. He just wants to be a hired servant. And the father won't even give him a chance. The father's forgiveness is offered immediately and completely. And yet there's more, right? Now the Pharisees are just squirming because to them, this is so in defiance of what they believe. Because they have the law. And the whole purpose of the law is to atone for sin. You can't be forgiven for your sin easily. Right? It just doesn't work that way. This is something that even to kind of take this into a modern context, we and Catholics would disagree about. If you have some friends that are Catholic or if you come from a Catholic background, one of the issues they have with Protestantism is that our idea of grace seems so easy because you don't have to do anything. You just ask for forgiveness and you're given forgiveness. And to Catholic mindset, that just they struggle with that because it seems too simple. It seems like there's just not enough. Something's got to be required. That's their whole doctrine of penance. Right? You've got to do something to make it up. You've got to have some skin in the game. There's got to be something that you do to demonstrate your contrition, to demonstrate your recognition that it's sin. You've got to pay back what you've done. You've offended God. You've got to do something. You can't just be forgiven just because you want to be forgiven. But that's what's going on here. And the Pharisees are just, they can't believe this. What's the point of all the sacrifices? What's the point of all the rituals? Why do we have all of this in the Old Testament if we're not going to use it? If you're just going to be forgiven without even asking for forgiveness, well, what's the point of this? They don't get it. the Pharisees don't get it, because what they don't get is that the law was never about your own atonement for sin. Right? It was never, okay, you did this, so go get something else to sacrifice. That's how the law worked. Right? You sinned, therefore sacrifice two pigeons. You sin, therefore you need a grain offering. You sin, therefore this. Built into the law is the understanding that you can't make up for your own sin. There has to be a substitute. Somebody else, there has to be another element involved here. Right? This goes back to Abraham. You guys know the story. Abraham and Isaac are having that wonderful long walk where Abraham knows what's about to happen. Isaac does not know what's about to happen. And Isaac, being that kind of curious teenage-ish kind of preteen about kind of age, kind of goes, hey, Dad, where's the sacrifice? What are we going to kill? I mean, we got the wood, we got the stuff, we're going out, we're going to worship, but we don't have an animal. What's up? And Abraham says, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering. And that's mentioned very specifically in that case, but it is also meant as something that I think we can take as a truth throughout Scripture. We see it again at Passover. Right? At Passover. Blood is required for the forgiveness of sins, but it's not the blood of the sinner. Right? Passover is not, okay, you've all sinned, therefore open a vein and spread that on your doors. No, it's not your blood. It's a substitute. For the forgiveness of sins, the blood of the Savior is needed. That is what the Pharisees don't get. But Jesus isn't done yet. And this is great, because the father knows that the whole village saw this kid sin, right? This kid sinned. It wasn't some private secret thing where nobody knew. Everybody had to know this, right? I mean, the father had to find somebody to buy the land, right? Because he's got to sell off a part of his land. He had to liquidate his possessions. The boy had to sell those to people, probably at a cheap rate because he just wants to cash out. How much for my set of the dining room chairs, right? Who'll give me $50? The whole village was involved in this. Everybody knew the sin. And the father is going to make sure that everybody knows the forgiveness. His kid sinned publicly. This kid is going to be forgiven publicly. And he does that in this way. The father just starts barking out commands to his servants. Now, I think partly it's because he's probably out of breath, but maybe that's just what would happen to me if I ran that far, right? He doesn't have very complete sentence. Get her off. And kill a calf, okay? I mean, that's about all he can get out. He's just giving short, direct orders. But the things that he's talking about are important. And they would have been important to the people. By now, people are gathering around. The servants had run out there. I'm sure the servants kind of followed, like, what has gone wrong with this guy? Right? You can just imagine they're kind of following along, like, is this guy just lost his mind? Everybody's beginning to gather. What is going on? What's going on is this. The Father is going to show not only that you are forgiven, but that you are restored to a certain position in this family. It's not like, okay, I'll forgive you, but you're over there. That's not the forgiveness the Father is offering. He wants everybody in the village to see that his son is forgiven and that his son is a son. And he does that with sandals. Slaves don't wear sandals. Servants don't wear sandals. Only the members of the family wore sandals. And he's going to let the village know this kid is not some hired servant. He's not somebody that's going to have to earn his way back in. He is coming back right now as a first-class citizen. He is a member of the family. That's what the sandals signify. The idea that this kid is right back where he left in terms of his position within the family. And again, you got to notice that the father does this without any conditions. Right? There's not sort of a waiting period. There's not sort of a, okay, you're back. Are you really sorry, or were you just kind of hungry and smelling a pig? So we'll tell you what. We'll give you 6 months. See if you can behave yourself. Show that you've learned your lesson. And then we'll maybe put this plan into operation. It's not what the Father does. Right now, you're back. Father, I said, it's okay. Don't worry about that. Give my kid some shoes. He needs shoes. He's been walking in his bare feet. He is a member of this family. Give my kid some shoes. Right? The Father doesn't talk it over with the elder brother. He doesn't, well, I wonder what the local rabbi would think. Or maybe the village elders. Right? He doesn't care about that. There is no reason to bring anybody else into the conversation. The son has returned, and he is welcomed back as a son. And then his father gets a ring. The ring is probably what was called a signet ring. It's a ring you would see that would often have, as it got more elaborate in time, some sort of seal or something on it, or an engraving. You can probably see this if you've seen movies like in the Middle Ages. You see a king kind of wax over an envelope and then stamp it with a ring to kind of show that this was my seal, right? It's that kind of ring. This wasn't probably as elaborate, but it was an important ring. It was something that a wealthy person would have, and it was something that was distinctive. Okay, it wasn't just like, you know, rings we have today where we might have 3 or 4 or 5. Pharaoh had a ring like this, right? You remember this. It says Pharaoh took off his signet ring, put it in Joseph's hand, clothed him with garments of linen, and put the gold necklace around his neck. And the point of that was it signified Joseph's position, right? I mean, not so much the gold necklace and the robes. Everybody that was at Pharaoh's court had some of that stuff. But there's only one ring, right? And Joseph, you are second only to Pharaoh, so here, you have my ring. Okay, you're in my place. That's what this father is bringing for his son. Think about that. He gets what should be the elder brother's. This is the elder brother's ring that's going to pass to him. The son, the younger son, the sinful son gets this because it's a symbol of authority. Okay? Again, he's letting everybody in the village know as they gather around that my son is welcomed back to all the rights and privileges of sonship. You know, there's a word for that in Roman law. It's called usufruct, which is kind of a funny old word. But what it really means is, it comes from the word fruit. That fruct is kind of fruit. And it means that somebody has the opportunity to use the fruits of something. Okay, think like a tree, right? You get to use the fruits of the tree. It doesn't mean you own it. You don't own it. But you get to use whatever the possessions are. That's what's symbolized by this. What the father is saying is that my younger son comes back. This is not his property. These are not his fields. These are not his servants. They belong to me now, and they will all go to the elder son. But this younger son gets to use that during my lifetime. He is entitled to help himself to whatever is available. He gets the use of all of this. He's not some outsider that has to ask permission. He is restored as an equal. The robe, again, like the ring, is a unique item. It is something that there's not a lot of. You don't have a whole closet full of these. These are very special. They would be worn on special occasions. A very typical one would be, say, a wedding of a son or something like that. You would get this out. This was not sort of what you hung around the house in. It's valuable. It's irreplaceable. And get this, the father just throws it on this kid who's looking and smelling like you can imagine. Right? I mean, he doesn't even... Okay, what you need is a bath. And after you bathe, then I'll give you the robe. It's like, no, right here, wrap him up in it. I want everybody to see this. I want everybody in the village to see him in the best robe, the family robe. See it now. I don't care that he smells like pig. I don't care that he's dirty. I don't care that he's been walking. That's what he gets. That this would have been given to this rebellious son, that this is the treatment has to just astonish these Pharisees. That the father does it without any conditions is unimaginable. How do you just forgive like that? But Jesus still isn't finished, right? There's one more part of it. And bring the fatted calf and kill it. So He's brought his son back. He has demonstrated to the village that his son is not just forgiven, but fully restored to the place he was before he ever left. Okay? It's as if it never happened. It's as if it never happened. And now, he's going to throw a party for everybody. For everybody. He's going to take this sort of moment of his family's rejoicing and throw a party for the village. Okay, now again, we can learn a few things from this. The fact that this would have we all know the fatted calf, but let me explain kind of what that means. It means that this is an animal that is specially raised to be eaten. Okay, now you might think, well, yeah, what else do you use animals for? Well, usually you would use them for breeding, things like that. Chickens, right? Once you eat your chicken, you know what you don't have anymore? Eggs. Right? I mean, until you eat the chicken, you can have eggs for a really long time. Once you eat the chicken, you're out of eggs. Okay, get the idea? So if you have an animal, you can use the product of that animal. It's a sheep, you can use the wool time after time. If you have a cow, you can milk it. But once you kill it, well, it's kind of dead. So for a family to have an animal set aside just to kill means they must have plenty of other animals as well. This is a sign that this family is well off, which you can just imagine again what that kid must have took them for. It's the first century in Palestine. We have meat everywhere, right? We go to Costco, we get these, it's just full of meat, right? But in the first century, meat is a luxury. And most of the protein in that diet is going to be supplied by fish or by chickens, right? So if you like fish and chickens, you probably would have no trouble time traveling back. If you're a beef eater, first century Palestine is not the place you want to go, okay? Remember, you're Jewish, so you can't have pork. So you're kind of back to fish and chicken, all right? So that's all you got. This is a grain-fed calf. It's a fatted calf. What that means is not just that it's fat. What it means is that it's been raised in a pen so it doesn't wander around, because as animals wander around, they build up muscle. And as we all know, the more muscle you have, the less fat, right? We get that. I mean, that's kind of a modern physiological thing. It works for people. It works for animals. So you keep this animal fit, kind of fenced in. That means it can't graze. That means you have to feed it. You feed it grain, because that will fatten it up. That's expensive. You know, if you're just living sort of harvest to harvest, like 98% of the people, you don't feed animals grain. You let them wander and kind of graze. You need the grain, right? You need to make that into bread. You need to eat that yourself. You can't just give it to an animal. Again, the point of this is how opulent this family is. They can have an animal set aside that we're going to just feed grain and let it stay in its pen and get nice and fat. Because we want fat. We don't want meat. We want fat. Because fat tastes good. Don't believe anything fake. Okay? And it's going to be eaten at about 5 to 6 months old, because that's when it's most tender. Now, I'm making just a big deal about this, but if you go shopping today, if you can find veal, price it out. It will be expensive. Okay? Veal is not cheap even today, when we can mass produce it and get them fat with hormones and all kinds of stuff that's not good for you. But back then, this was an extraordinary animal. Probably, in fact, it was probably the kind of thing that a family, like if you know somebody's getting married, you would try to condition the breeding around it so that the calf was like 5 months old, right? So it's like, oh, you guys are getting married in for Christmas. Okay, great. You start with this, or let's plant a calf, because that way it'll be about right. That's that kind of special animal that it was. So this family just got one around. It might even already be designated for some event. And the father says, no, kill it now. Whatever we were going to serve, we'll serve something else. We'll serve soup to that one. Today, we kill the fatted calf. And that's what he does. He orders the calf to be killed. And this is going to be a celebration, right? This is going to be, if you're familiar with this at all, my son has never done a calf. He does pigs. But you kill a pig, and you eat off that pig for a long time. That's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. A calf, 500-600 pounds. Yeah. That's a lot of meat, okay? Let's say you wind up with 350 pounds of usable meat. No refrigeration. Better have a few hundred people around, because we got to pound this sucker out in about a week, right? We got to get this done. He's killing this to throw a party for everybody. This is not just sort of the celebration of the family and, hey, let's include the servants. This is for the village. This has to be one of the great celebrations in that village that they could remember, right? That's the point Jesus is making. This father rejoices in a way that is off the charts. He doesn't just rejoice with his sons. He doesn't just include the servants. This father's joy is such that he invites the whole town. Whoever wants, come on in, because we got about 300 pounds of veal on the barbecue. Let's grab some. And that's what it says, right? It says they began to celebrate. This is a party that's going to go on for a while. This is not just a, hey, stop by for lunch. This is a celebration this village is going to be involved in for a week. Wow. Can you imagine what the Pharisees are thinking? That this rebellious prodigal son gets this kind of a treat. What in the world is the father thinking? What would make this dad do that? Well, he tells you. Right? He says it in verse 24. He gives the reason. This son of mine was dead, has come to life again. He was lost and he's been found. This son had made up his mind to go down a road that could lead only to destruction. The father knew that when the kid left. Right? If you've got kids, you know, right? You see habits in your kids, you go, I know where that's going to take you. I know where that road goes. He knew that. Now the son is back. There's the possibility of a fruitful, productive, God-honoring life again. This child is restored. You know, I just conclude with this. I don't know that there is a more clear illustration of God's generous, undeserved, unconditional love in any other Jesus parables. I mean, there's times where he puts that in different ways, but in terms of parables, this father is as good a Christ figure as I'm aware of. So let's rejoice today in our Father. He is as prodigal with his grace to us as this father was. He restores us to life. Let's rejoice in that, shall we? Lord, we give you the glory because it is you that has brought us back. Lord, while we were still sinners, your grace infused us and turned us to you. Lord, if left to ourselves, we would still be wallowing with the pigs. But it is your call in our life that has brought us back. And you are generous with your love for us. You are generous with your forgiveness. You restore us to a place of sonship. It says we are adopted as sons. You give us things that we have no right to. And that we have done everything in our power to prove we don't deserve. And yet you forgive us. Lord, what a great illustration. May we reflect on that and consider that today. In Jesus' name. Amen.